Today is Thursday, April 30th, and this is the World Socialist Website. The latest round of tech layoffs at Microsoft and Meta shows the need for a working class movement to defend jobs, by Tom Hall. Shockwaves are continuing to spread throughout the technology sector as mass layoffs accelerate across the United States. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are being cut as the ruling class utilizes artificial intelligence and other technological advances to eliminate vast sections of the workforce. In just the past week, Meta announced 8,000 layoffs and froze 6,000 open positions, while Microsoft unveiled plans for up to 8,750 voluntary layoffs. These follow a wave of earlier cuts, including 30,000 layoffs at Oracle in March and 4,000 job eliminations, nearly 40% of the workforce at Block, the parent company of Square and Cash App. Block CEO Jack Dorsey spelled out the broader implications, declaring, quote, "Within the next year, I believe the majority of companies will reach the same conclusion and make similar structural changes." The scale of the offensive is enormous. In the first quarter of 2026 alone, over 217,000 job cuts were announced across the U.S. economy, according to Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. Of those, over 27,000 were explicitly attributed to artificial intelligence, including a full quarter of all layoffs in March. What is striking is that these cuts are not the product of economic weakness. The companies carrying them out are among the most profitable in the world. At the very moment they are shedding tens of thousands of workers, they are pouring unprecedented sums into AI infrastructure. Meta has projected capital expenditures of up to $145 billion this year. Amazon spent $44.2 billion on its cloud division in just the first quarter, while Microsoft reported surging growth in its AI-driven cloud business. A recent Wall Street Journal article declared the era of the mega layoff, noting that the stock market is actively rewarding companies for announcing large-scale job cuts, particularly when they are tied to AI restructuring. Driving this process is not only the promise of higher productivity, but the expectation within ruling circles that new technologies will sharply reduce or even eliminate the need for human labor. Mustafa Suleiman, head of Microsoft's AI division, recently predicted that, quote, "most, if not all, professional tasks," unquote, could be automated within the next 12 to 18 months. Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff has likewise declared that, quote, "we are the last generation to manage only humans," unquote. OpenAI investor Vinod Khosla predicted to Fortune magazine that 80% of all jobs, quote, "will be capable of being done by an AI," unquote, by 2030. The upheaval in tech is only the leading edge of a much broader offensive. Across the economy, jobs are being eliminated in logistics, manufacturing, and the public sector. The federal workforce has been cut by hundreds of thousands, as the government is reshaped to serve the interests of finance capital and militarism. In the auto industry, layoffs are accelerating amid slowing electric vehicle sales and the reduced labor requirements of EV production, with General Motors reducing its flagship Factory Zero plant to one shift in Detroit. The largest cuts by any private employer are taking place at UPS, which is carrying out a sweeping Network of the Future restructuring aimed at eliminating large portions of its warehouse workforce. On Wednesday, the company announced plans to close 27 additional parcel centers this year. Meanwhile, a manufactured financial crisis at the U.S. Postal Service is being used to slash pension obligations and push forward plans for privatization. But for a whole layer of software engineers, developers, analysts, and other technical workers, the jobs bloodbath in the high-tech sector are a particularly abrupt collapse. During the decades-long expansion of the tech sector, they were encouraged to see themselves as part of a privileged middle class, insulated from the insecurities faced by other workers. High salaries, stock options, and the mythology of the startup economy foster the belief that they stood outside the basic class divisions of capitalist society. That illusion has disintegrated with unprecedented speed. Tech workers are being laid off en masse, replaced by smaller teams augmented by AI systems and subjected to intensifying labor discipline. They are discovering that they are sellers of labor power, whose fate is inseparably bound up with that of the working class as a whole. The defense of jobs, therefore, requires a break with the existing framework. It requires the mobilization of the working class on the basis of its own independent interests, in opposition to inequality, oligarchy, and capitalist exploitation. This, in turn, raises the necessity for new forms of organization, including rank-and-file committees, through which workers can organize resistance outside the control of the established apparatuses. The International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, or IWARFC, is spearheading the development of these organizations to unite workers in a common struggle. In those workplaces that are unionized, the union bureaucracy has for decades collaborated with management in the name of competitiveness, a process that is now reaching its logical conclusion. Under conditions in which the ruling class is seeking to permanently displace vast sections of the workforce, the old slogan of a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, which left capitalist property unchallenged, itself has become untenable. At the same time, workers must reject all political subordination to the Democratic Party. As the party of Wall Street, it has responded to the crisis with occasional liberal rhetoric, while refusing to seriously oppose the authoritarian policies of the Trump administration. In various forums, Bernie Sanders has advanced proposals for regulating AI, such as a 32-hour work week, profit-sharing schemes, and worker representation on corporate boards. But these amount to calls for self-regulation by the corporations themselves. On the last proposal in particular, Sanders cites Germany as a model. But this has only served as a mechanism through which German union officials collaborate in enforcing layoffs and suppressing strikes in the name of social partnership. The ruling class hopes to use AI to open up new sources of surplus value and to stabilize a social system burdened by unsustainable levels of debt and mounting financial instability. The mass unemployment they hope to create through AI is also a political weapon to be used to discipline workers and suppress resistance. The AI boom is also intensifying global conflicts. Competition over semiconductors, rare earth materials, energy, and supply chains is sharpening geopolitical tensions, while militarization is being accelerated to secure strategic advantage. War, from the standpoint of the ruling class, serves not only to conquer markets and resources, but also to destroy accumulated capital that can no longer be profitably employed. Capitalism, not the development of technology, is the cause of mass layoffs. Artificial intelligence has the capacity to automate vast amounts of repetitive labor, increase productivity, and lay the material foundation for a dramatic reduction in the amount of labor required to sustain society. The problem is that under capitalism, every advance in labor-saving technology is transformed into a means of intensifying exploitation and destroying jobs. So long as they remain in private hands, they will be used to enrich a financial oligarchy at the expense of society as a whole. This raises the necessity for a program based on the expropriation of the major technology firms and their transformation into publicly owned utilities, under the democratic control of the working class. The same must apply to the banks, investment funds, and other financial institutions that direct the flow of capital into these industries. On this basis, workers must fight for concrete demands. No layoffs, guaranteed employment, a shorter work week with no loss in pay, workers' control over the implementation of new technologies, and the use of productivity gains to expand healthcare, education, housing, and public infrastructure. The construction of data centers and related infrastructure must be carried out on the basis of rational democratic planning, rather than the anarchic pursuit of profit. Tech workers must unite with the broader working class. Their struggle is not separate, but part of a common fight against a system that subordinates all aspects of social life to private profit. The fight against layoffs is, in the final analysis, a fight against capitalism itself. The theme of the International Committee of the Fourth International's May Day rally, to unify workers internationally in the struggle against capitalism, imperialist war, and the global assault on democratic rights, finds direct expression in this developing movement. The fight for workers' control over technology is a central component of that struggle. Supreme Court Steps Up Attacks on Democratic Rights by Patrick Martin. The U.S. Supreme Court continues its charge to the right with a decision that further guts the Voting Act and oral arguments on ending temporary protected status for Haitian and Syrian immigrants, in which a majority of justices seemed ready to uphold the action of the Trump administration that could lead to the deportation of more than 1 million legal immigrants. The decision in Louisiana v. Calais, the 6-3 ultra-right majority struck down redistricting of the state's congressional seats, which created a second black majority district, now occupied by Representative Cleo Fields. The court ordered the state to redraw the map without using race as the major factor. The decision is the culmination of a nearly two-decade assault on the Voting Rights Act, which was adopted in 1965 to put an end to long-standing suppression of black voters' democratic rights, mainly in the southern U.S. states dominated by segregation. In an earlier decision, Shelby v. Holder, the court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which provided for federal oversight and preclearance of election law changes in states with a long history of discrimination. Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote that decision, claimed that so much progress had been made in the South that federal oversight was no longer required. The much less effective individual oversight of the states provided for in Section 2, through expensive lawsuits filed in the federal courts, was claimed to be the remaining enforcement power. But now this, too, has been gutted. While the decision handed down by Justice Samuel Alito did not strike down Section 2, it rendered it a dead letter, finding that plaintiffs had to prove intent to discriminate in the minds of state officials, not merely show that the results of state action were discriminatory. The court's three moderate liberals signed a dissent written by Justice Elena Kagan, which strongly attacked the majority ruling, calling it the, quote, demolition of the Voting Rights Act, unquote. The text of the Voting Rights Act and previous court precedent strongly support Kagan's dissent, but her argument remains mired in racial politics. She declares that black voters constitute a racial community and should be allowed to elect their representatives, that is, black congressmen. As with affirmative action, there is a right-wing critique of the racial identity politics of the Democratic Party, the blatant racism of Trump and his fascist cabal, and a left-wing critique, the fight for the unity of the working class waged by the Socialist Equality Party. The SCP opposes the claim by the Democrats that black workers are appropriately represented by black capitalists and multimillionaires. More than a half century of experience with the advancement of black mayors, congressmen, CEOs, and the first black president, the imperialist war criminal Barack Obama, show beyond any doubt that the class divisions within capitalist society are far more significant than the racial divisions. The civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 1960s produced lasting gains in terms of democratic rights and the ability of the working class to overcome the racial divisions exploited by right-wing demagogues like George Wallace. Interracial marriages now number in the millions, and the children of such marriages are many millions more. What is required to defend these gains is the mobilization of the working class against the capitalist system as a whole, based on political independence from all sections of the capitalist class, including the black democratic politicians who invariably side with the billionaires and the military intelligence apparatus against the working class. The most immediate effect of the Supreme Court ruling will be to damage the prospects of the Democratic Party in the midterm elections set for November 5th. Hence the outcry from the congressional Democrats and the sections of the corporate media aligned with them. Republican state legislatures in Louisiana, Alabama, and other states where a handful of minority districts have been carved out, in large measure to guarantee Republican control of most districts, are expected to redraw lines that eliminate even that handful, eliminating as many as 12 Democratic-held seats by one estimate. Some states will be unable to redraw the boundaries in time, so the impact on the 2026 vote remains uncertain. Given the poll numbers showing a likely large swing to the Democrats, it is entirely possible that the rigging of district lines will backfire on the Republicans, causing them to lose the larger number of marginal seats that gerrymandering will create. The two main capitalist parties have been engaged in a gerrymandering war for nearly a year, since Trump demanded that Texas break precedent and redraw its boundaries in the middle of the decade, rather than after the decennial census, as has been the tradition for two centuries. While Republicans redrew district maps in Texas, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Ohio, the Democrats did the same in California, New York, New Jersey, and Virginia. This week, Florida adopted a map that would supposedly shift four seats from the Democrats to the Republicans. The entire process demonstrates the sclerotic character of capitalist democracy in America, which has been fatally undermined by deepening social inequality. Both parties defend the interests of a few thousand billionaires, bankers, and corporate CEOs who control the economy, the media, and the government, but live in constant fear of a movement from below, from a vast working class majority. While the Voting Rights Act ruling captured the headlines, oral arguments held the same day suggest that an even more ominous and anti-democratic ruling is imminent. Two cases are being consolidated, Trump v. Meehan, which challenges the termination of temporary protective status for 365,000 Haitian refugees, and Mullen v. Doe, which does the same for 6,000 Syrian refugees. The TPS cases were heard on the final day of oral arguments for this term, so the decision is not likely to be announced until late June or early July. The plaintiffs, individual TPS holders, Haitians, and Syrians, challenged the decision by Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem to revoke their status. The precedent set would apply to more than 1 million immigrants who presently have legal status under TPS, which the White House wants to revoke. As the oral arguments proceeded, four right-wing judges were largely silent, seeming to agree with Trump, while the three moderate liberals were clearly opposed. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioned both Solicitor General John Sauer and the plaintiff's lawyers, but seemed likely to side with the anti-immigrant bigot in the White House when a decision is finally rendered. Solicitor General Sauer argued for absolute executive authority over TPS determinations, saying that the federal courts had no jurisdiction over decisions made by the Department of Homeland Security, according to the law which established TPS procedures. The plaintiffs concede that the 1990 law establishing TPS gives the secretary unreviewable power to make a final decision, but point to the requirement that the government follow a consultative process, making an assessment of the conditions that prevail in each country before revoking TPS. Noem, who was fired by Trump in February, simply announced the decision on Trump's orders without any consultation at all. Even if the court finds for the plaintiffs, this would only delay the mass deportation, since the DHS will go through the formality of consultation and then obey Trump's predetermined decision, issuing the order to leave the country. Haitian immigrants were first granted TPS status in 2010, after the earthquake that killed 300,000 and leveled much of the impoverished country, the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. TPS has been repeatedly extended, as security conditions have collapsed and armed gangs in the pay of the tiny Haitian elite effectively rule the country. Syrian refugees received TPS after civil war broke out in the country in 2011, instigated by the CIA and Saudi Arabia. It was extended several times as the conflict ebbed and flowed, and again after the 2023 earthquake, which hit northern Syria and adjacent portions of Turkey, killing 60,000. after the ouster of longtime ruler Bashar al-Assad, an ally of Russia, the country is now ruled by an offshoot of al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, whose leader, Ahmed al-Shawaz, was welcomed at the White House earlier this year. Macron wants to use war on Iran to wage class war in France, by Alex Lantier. Trump's blockade of Iran and his threat to exterminate Iranian civilization mark a new era in the international class struggle. The setback suffered by Trump, whose war of aggression has not yet succeeded in imposing a neo-colonial regime on Iran, is evident. But the European bourgeoisie is responding by preparing a social and economic offensive targeting workers' rights and living standards. This is perhaps most clearly the case with French President Emmanuel Macron, who has condemned neither the war against Iran nor the blockade cutting off Europe's energy supply. Ignoring the threat of economic depression, his government is preparing to use it as a pretext to impose austerity measures already overwhelmingly rejected by the French people. A glaring contradiction exists between his comments and those of Total Energy CEO Patrick Pouyanné, who stressed the looming energy crisis on Friday at a conference organized in Chantilly by the French Institute of International Relations, or IFRI, think tank. France, Pouyanné said, risks entering into, quote, an era of energy shortages like those already being experienced by some Asian countries. If this war and this blockade last more than 3 months, we will begin to face serious supply problems for certain products, such as kerosene, unquote. He added, quote, the shortage is not yet present in the Atlantic basin, but we cannot afford to leave 20% of the world's oil and gas reserves, that is, those of the Persian Gulf region, inaccessible without major consequences. Various experts confirmed Poyanné's remarks. Terry Bross, a professor at the Political Sciences Institute, said, quote, shortage is at Europe's doorstep. Pointing to, quote, ships passing through only in dribs and drabs, he added, quote, to govern is to foresee. But the Macron government acts as if governing means foreseeing nothing. It has not condemned Trump's strangulation of Europe's energy supply any more than it condemned his genocidal threats against Iran. Traveling on Saturday to Athens, Macron was instead downplaying the risks posed by the war and implicitly criticizing Pouyanné. Asked by a journalist about the danger of an energy shortage, Macron replied that he had nothing to say on the subject. Quote, we are not in the scenario that is one of the worst-case scenarios you have described, which is not today the most probable, and which I need not comment upon. I think I can tell you at this stage that the situation is under control. And today, the situation does not lead us to envisage any shortage, unquote. In fact, the energy crisis very much threatens shortages not only in Asia, but also in Europe. While it takes, for now, the form of soaring prices rather than a generalized shortage, it is because on March 11th, the International Energy Agency's 32 member countries, including the U.S. and European powers, released 400 million barrels of oil from their strategic reserves. It was the largest release of reserves in IEA history. But this will not resolve the crisis if the war continues and, within a few months, these strategic reserves begin to run out. The war is genuinely blocking France's energy supply. But Macron implied that Total's concerns were panic that could create a crisis out of thin air. He said the worst thing in these moments of tension and geopolitical uncertainty is for those tensions to be heightened by panic behavior. And quite often, shortages are created by panic itself. In reality, the risk of energy shortages and economic depression is not an alarmist fairy tale invented by scaremongers. Trump's war against Iran is creating a real crisis. The current surge in oil prices and the shortages at certain gas stations in France are the forewarnings of a wider economic and military earthquake that will shock the world if workers fail to stop the war. The warning from the CEO of Total a company that plays a central role in the French stock exchange as well as in the French state, reveals that Macron is covering up these dangers, not out of ignorance, but knowingly. He decided this behind the backs of the French people. Indeed, shortly before the start of the war, he sent a private text in English to Trump, calling to, quote, do great things together, unquote, in Iran. With breathtaking irresponsibility, he is gambling with his country's economy and jobs. His relationship with the genocidal lunatic in the White House constitutes the greatest, though least commended, act of betrayal since Pétain, who claimed that collaborating with Hitler would regenerate France through a national revolution. Macron tramples underfoot what bourgeois commentators normally call France's national interests, such as its energy security. This confirms a central tenet of Marxism. Indeed, the national interests invoked by the bourgeoisie are nothing but a mystification concealing the pursuit of class interests. If Macron covers for Trump while the latter grips Europe's economy by the throat, it is because Macron defends imperialism. French imperialism does not want a U.S. defeat, at least for now, as it fears the impact of such a defeat on its own military bases in the Middle East, its arms exports to Arab sheikdoms, and the role of its banks in the world oil trade. Condemning Trump's genocidal threats against Iran would also call into question Macron's friendship with the Israeli regime amid the Gaza genocide. The military crisis of French imperialism is inseparable from the social crisis it wishes to resolve at workers' expense. Since the sellout of the strikes against pension cuts by the parties of the New Popular Front in the union bureaucracies in 2023, Macron has ruled openly against the people. A series of minority governments has tried to impose drastic austerity, but this policy, based on a refusal to tax the wealthy, has not managed to reduce the deficit, as Paris is also increasing military spending by tens of billions of euros. The French government is now trying to use the crisis provoked by Trump's war of aggression against Iran for its domestic political agenda of class war. Rather than condemning the genocide and U.S. military aggression, the government is exploiting them to create a political framework to intensify austerity against workers. This is clearly indicated by statements of Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu. Last week, he declared in a letter to his ministers that, quote, the total cost of the crisis could therefore amount to at least 6 billion euros to date, unquote. Public Accounts Minister David Amiel responded by declaring that, quote, any new public expenditure that might be made necessary by the energy crisis would entail the cancellation of previously planned expenditure, euro for euro, unquote. Macron is thus seizing on the Iranian crisis to enshrine the principle of zero increase in net spending, which, without taxation of the wealthy, inevitably means draconian austerity. To fight this policy, workers must draw the lessons of the sellout of the 2023 strikes. Workers will need to wage a long-term struggle and, to do so, organize independently at the level of the rank and file to wrest control of their struggles from the union bureaucracies. 3 years ago, these bureaucracies refused any struggle that could bring down Macron. However, without such a struggle, it will be impossible to stop the war and the economic crisis. Above all, workers in France and internationally must unite. All face the danger of an economic depression and a generalized military conflagration. The decisive question is the building of an international anti-war movement of the working class, based on a perspective of stripping power from the warmongering capitalist oligarchies and building a socialist society. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.